Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatya De Satarane Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Cha Panchakalpa Jubhascha, keep us in the Vibhatapati, Tanam Pavanevio, Vaishnavevi Namo Namo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
October 26, 2022, from Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 5, with Lord Rishabhdev's teachings to his sons, chapter the Prabhupada quoted from a lot, text 28. Now, this is in prose, and it is very long. I will
muted.
I will try my best.
Unmuted.
I will try my best here. Sri Sukha Uvacha Evam Anu Shashyat Majam Swayam Anu Shishtam Api Lok Anu Shash Anartam Mahanubhavaha Parama Surid Bhagavan Rishabha Padesha Upashama Shilanam Uparata Karmanam Mahamuninam Bhakti Gyanam Vairagya Lakshanam Paramahamsya dharmam upashikshamanaha swatanaya shata jeshtam parama bhagavatam bhagavadjana parayana bharatam dharani palanaya bish ikshya swayam bhavana evor varita sharira matra parigraha unmata Iva gagana paridhana pakirna kesha atmani aropitaha vaniyo brahma vartat pravarvaja. Sri Sukha Uvacha. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said.
I muted everybody. Should I unmute or?
No, they can just say and it won't be audible. That's fine. Evam, in this way, Anushasya, after instructing Atmajan, his sons, Swayam, personally, Anushishtan, highly educated in culture, Api, although, Loka Anushashana Artam, just to instruct the people. Maha Anubhavaha, the great personality. Parama Surit, everyone's sublime well-wisher. Bhagavan, the supreme personality of Godhead. Rishabha Apadesha, who is celebrated and known as Rishabhadev. Upashama Shilanam, of persons who have no desire for material enjoyment. Uparata karmanam, who are no longer interested in fruitive activities. Mahamuninam, who are sannyasis. Bhakti, devotional service. Jnana, perfect knowledge. Vairagya, detachment. Lakshanam, characterized by. Paramahamsya, of the best of human beings. Dharmam, the duties. Upashikshamanaha, instructing. Swatanaya, of his sons. Shata, 100. Jeshtam, the eldest. Parama Bhagavatam, a topmost devotee of the Lord. Bhagavajana Parayanam, a follower of the devotee of the Lord. Brahmanas and Vaishnavas. Bharatam, Bharat Maharaj. Dharani Palanaya, with a view to ruling the world. Abhish Ichya, placing on the throne. Swayam, personally. Bhavane, at home. Eva, although. Urvarita, remaining. Sharira Matra, the body only. Parigraha, accepting. Unmataha, a madman. Eva, exactly like. Gagana Paridhanaha, taking the sky as his dress. That's a common euphemism for being naked in Sanskrit. Prakirna Kesha, having scattered hair. Atmani, in himself. Aropita, keeping. Ahavan Iyaha, the Vedic fire. Brahmavartat, from the place known as Brahmavarta. Pavaraja began to travel all over the world. Srila Prabhupada's translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, thus the great well-wisher of everyone, the Supreme Lord Rishabhadev, instructed his own sons. Although they were perfectly educated and cultured, he instructed them just to set an example of how a father should instruct his sons before retiring from family life. Sannyasis who are no longer bound by fruitive activity and who have taken to devotional service after all their material desires have been vanquished also learn by these instructions. Lord Rishabhadev instructed his 100 sons, of whom the eldest Bharata was a very advanced devotee and a follower of Vaishnavas. In order to rule the whole world, the Lord enthroned his eldest son on the royal seat. Thereafter, although still at home, Lord Rishabhadev lived like a madman, naked and with disheveled hair. Then the Lord took the sacrificial fire within himself, and he left Brahmavarta to tour the whole world. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Actually, the instructions given to Lord Rishabhadev's sons were not exactly meant for his sons, because they were already educated and highly advanced in knowledge. Rather, these instructions were meant for sannyasis who intend to become advanced devotees. Sannyasis must abide by Lord Rishabhadev's instructions while on the path of devotional service. Lord Rishabhadev retired from family life and lived like a naked madman, even while still with his family. So this verse talks about how Lord Rishabhadev, the instructions themselves are concluded. Sukadeva Goswami is telling us that these instructions were given by Rishabhadev, who is an incarnation of the Lord, for the benefit of everyone, for the benefit of his sons. He had 100 sons, especially for the benefit of his eldest, Jyestha Bharat, who was going to rule the world. He was going to work in the world. He was going to be, we think of the king as the epitome of a materialistic person. Indeed, Mahaprabhu thought like that, that King Prataparudra, who was just the king of Orissa, one state, what we would call in America a governor. He was the king of one state. That he epitomized materialistic life because he was a king. A chief government ruler is going to be handling a tremendous amount of money. One devotee here worked as an architect for the school system of one county, of one state, and she said she was regularly handling millions of dollars. So imagine if you are the governor of the state, how much money you're handling. So much money, so many people, so much fame, so much influence. So the epitome of a materialistic person. Probably in 2022, we think of a wealthy business person as epitomizing a materialistic person, or perhaps a wealthy artisan, entertainer, so forth, as epitomizing a materialistic person. But we find generally in the Shastra it was the Kshatriyas who were considered the epitome of a materialist. Yes? So, but these instructions were meant for Bart, and they're also meant for the sannyasis. It's interesting that Prabhupada in his purport pretty much just concentrates on the sannyasis. But these instructions are meant for everyone. They were meant for young children who were going to take responsibility later on. They were meant for educated youth. They were meant for people who were going to take huge amounts of responsibility to rule the planet. I can't even imagine. I mean, just taking, for most of us, if we just take responsibility for one house and a family, it's a lot. So to take responsibility for a town, a village, you know, someone taking responsibility for one temple, one school, take responsibility for a town or a state or a country or the planet. And also for those who, as Prabhupada says here, that they've given up everything. They have no more desires to do anything in the world. They're just engaged in the 64 angas of bhakti. So for all of these people, Lord Rishabhadev gives these instructions, and then he himself transitions. He transitions from grihastha life to vanaprastha life. And this fact is quite significant, that while these instructions can be followed by anybody, whether they're a student, whether they're active in the world, or whether they're retired from the world, there is a time to retire from the world. I mean, obviously, if someone dies young while they're still active in the world, they can still be a pure devotee from that position. But it is advised that if one has a normal lifespan, that at the end of life, one's external activities change. And such is natural in human society. These ashramas coincide with natural tendencies of both the body and the mind. When we're children, we want to learn, we want to understand, we want to prepare. Naturally, our curiosity is unbounded for learning and studying. When we hit our youthful life, we want to engage in sexual affairs, we want to engage in making money, we want to make our mark on the world, we want to change something in the world, and these desires are very, very strong. And then when we hit middle age, then we start wanting to move back from these things. We no longer are capable of producing children, or at least not healthy children. And one isn't capable of working so much. People usually want to travel, take up something new. And then as the body gets older and dwindles, one wants to withdraw from life and prepare for the journey, prepare to transition. So this is natural, psychologically, physiologically, for the vast majority of normal, healthy human beings. And the ashram system is a way to spiritualize those stages. Study for the glory of God, raise a family and work in the world for the glory of God, retire for the glory of God, prepare for death for the glory of God. And I think it's very, what I really want to focus on here is, I mean, so many things we could talk about in this one verse. It's so rich. But I'm really going to focus on Atmani Aropita Ahavaniyaha, that he was keeping the Vedic fire within himself. So in one sense, this particular statement applies specifically to the renunciate. And especially, I mean, here he really sort of took a kind of vanaprastha, or he really becomes like a kind of avaduta, almost not really even like a normal vanaprastha or sannyasi. And this injunction is elsewhere in the Bhagavatam about when you're renounced, you take the sacred fire into yourself. You become a walking sacrificial fire I mean, here Rishabhdev doesn't even wear any clothes. He's wearing the sky, as it's euphemistically often said in Sanskrit. But the idea of the saffron cloth is that one is wearing clothing the color of this sacred fire. That one is a walking yajna. Whereas in grihastha life, one's yajnas are more external. And one is literally the house, it's the householders who are supposed to be performing most of the external yajnas with external fire. But this principle of being the personification of yajna actually applies to everyone. It's in one sense, all of us are meant to be that kind of a sannyasi. Even the young student, even the newly married person, everyone is meant to be a sannyasi in this sense, that we personify yajna. So I was thinking, there's this one gentleman, Charles Eisenstein, and he wrote, we should live our life as if every act is a ceremony, every word a prayer, every walk a pilgrimage, every place a shrine. And of course, this reminds us of Yat Kiroshi Yat Ignasi Yat Dehosi Dadasi Yat Yat Tapasyasi Kanteya Tat Purushva Vanarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, whatever acts of charity you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering unto me. And if there's a very, very similar verse in the Bible in Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. And then what happens is in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, Madarpanam Brahmahavir, we have this word Havir in 4:24, same as we have in today's verse, right? Atmani Aropita Ahavaniyaha Havan Havir. The butter. Brahmarpanam Brahmahavir Brahmagno Brahmanahutam Brahmayavatena Gantavyam Brahmakarma Samadina. A person who's fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness is sure to attain the spiritual kingdom because of his full contribution to spiritual activities, in which the consummation is absolute and that which is offered is of the same spiritual nature. In other words, the fire, the butter, the spoon for offering the fire, the person offering, everything is Brahman. That is the point. Everything, there's not really a difference. Right? As we go one verse back to 4:23. The work of a man who's unattached to the modes of material nature and who's fully situated in transcendental knowledge merges entirely into transcendence. Prabhupada writes in the purport, whatever he does for Krishna. Therefore, all his works are technically sacrifices. The resultant reactions to all such work merge into transcendence. One does not suffer material effects. Now, I brought up before, Prabhupada uses the word sacrifices for yajna, and the English word sacrifices means to give up something that's valuable to you. That's not what yajna means. Yajna means a ceremony. It means a ceremony to connect with God. I mean, you could also be connecting with someone else, but yajna, literally the main meaning of it in the scripture, is some kind of ceremony to connect with the Lord. And everything we do should be like that. I mean, there are particular ceremonies, and I've discussed this many times before, like if I want to call my son who lives in California, so I have to have some kind of device to call him with. I have to have a phone. He has to have a device to receive my call. He has to have a phone. I have to have his number. If I have one digit wrong, it won't work. My phone has to have an electrical charge. The battery has to be charged or it has to be plugged in. It has to have a connection to a phone network or an internet network. His phone has to have a charge. His phone has to be connected to a network. I have to dial the right number in the right order. And I also have to dial it at the right time because, you know, he's in a different time zone than I am. And so if I call him at 6 o'clock in the morning for me, that's 3 o'clock in the morning for him, and he probably won't answer the phone. So it's a kind of ceremony that I have to go through in order to call him. Right? It's a certain ritual, if I want to use a kind of a negative word. It's a kind of ritual that I have to go through if I want to connect with him. And so in every religion, there are formalized rituals for how to connect with God. Most of those rituals involve some sort of prayer, either said internally or out loud. Many of them involve some kind of lamp or fire, some kind of fragrance. They sometimes involve being at a particular shrine or place or altar. Sometimes they involve particular times, like the Gayatri Mantras, the prayers of the Muslims, the prayers of the Orthodox Jews. They involve particular times, so they may have to be said at particular times, particular places. There may be a particular position of the body, like for the Muslim prayers, they have particular positions of the body. One may have to be in a particular state of ritual cleanliness. One may have to have just bathed and put on clean clothes or something like that. And that's very much like, if I want to call my son, then all these other things have to be right. If I get one digit wrong, or if his phone isn't charged, or if he's sleeping, or it won't work. So there's ceremonies of connection to the Lord like that. And then there's ceremonies of connection to the Lord that are not so rigid, like chanting the holy name. So chanting the holy name can be done anywhere. You can chant the holy name in a filthy, contaminated place or in a clean place. You can chant at any time of the day or night. You can chant in your mind. You can chant out loud by yourself with others. You can sing. You can speak. It's very open. But there are rules of saying the holy name with love and affection or saying the holy name offensively. So if one is absorbed in the holy name offensively, then the connection will not take place. So there's not hard and fast rules like time and place and ritual cleanliness and things of that sort, but one has to be doing it with attention and with care and with love. Then there's also ways of connection at every moment. That, again, one makes oneself a sacrifice. One makes oneself a fire. And one is constantly in a state, again, I really like what Charles Eisenstein says, every act a ceremony, every word a prayer, every walk a pilgrimage, every place a shrine. So one can also live like that. One can become a walking holy place. And again, Rishabhdev does this very literally, and he does this at the stage of life where he retires from active, open acts of connection. And he lives as if he's a crazy person, naked with matted hair and not speaking to anyone and so forth. But he's in a state of connection all the time. But he's also giving these instructions to his sons who are working in the world. So how can we do this? What's the process? Well, actually, before we get to how, why don't we get to why? Why would we want to do this? Why would we want every act, every thought, every word, every step to be an act of a ceremony of connection? Like we read that Lord Varaha goes to the spiritual world where every day is a festival. But it's not just every day. It's every moment, every moment. And not, you know, any of you who've organized festivals, that might sound exhausting. It's like, I don't want a festival every day. Oh my God, you know. Like we just celebrated Govardhan Puja here in North Carolina. And, you know, there were, I don't know how many people came, probably about 1,000 came for Diwali and Govardhan Puja. And it's a huge thing. And you know, you have to organize all these people ahead of time and set up tents and, you know, practice dramas and dances and cook and cook and cook and cook and do lots of preparatory cleaning. And then when it's all over, then you've got to do lots of after cleaning and put away everything. And then you just, like, you're exhausted for the next 2 days. So it's not like that. But every day is full of joy. Why is it that we want to be connected? And what happens when we're connected? So this is something that Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita. One of my favorite verses is 6:20 to 23 in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna describes in a very general way what is perfection. Right? He says, in the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no gain or greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. This, indeed, is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. So the goal, the purpose, being connected all the time in love for Krishna, is one gets free from all miseries and one enters a state of unbounded joy, boundless transcendental happiness, where we are relishing and rejoicing in ourself. We are relishing and rejoicing in Krishna and our connection with him. We are meant to live like that. We are not meant to live miserable lives. that's not what we are designed for. And even one can say, well, Urmila, this world is miserable, that's just what it is. I really like something that Chaitanya Charan Prabhu was saying, that Himalaya, if we talk of the Sanskrit word for the Himalayas, Himalaya, Alaya means full of, and Hima means cold. So Himalaya means it's a cold place. And Krishna says, Dukalayam, this is a place full of misery. But the Himalayas are not just cold. People go to the Himalayas all the time. If it was only cold place, why would they go? It's also a place of beauty. It's a place of challenge. It's a place of inspiration. It's a place of awe. There's so much also there. It's not only a place of cold. So this material world is miserable for one who is not in a state of transcendental connection, for one who's not in a state of samadhi. Right? This indeed, Krishna says, is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Because when one is in a state of connection with Krishna, one is not in material contact. Generally, what we try to do in this world is we try to arrange our life so that it will not be miserable. But that's as ridiculous as trying to arrange to be warm in the Himalayas. How warm can you be? I mean, you can wear, you know, layers and layers of wool and down, and you can build fires and so forth. But the place is cold. You know, you're not going to feel in the Himalayas like you're going to feel in the beach in Hawaii in June. I mean, you're just not. It doesn't matter how much you adjust it. So in this world, we think, you know, I'm going to get the right job, I'm going to marry the right person, I'm going to get the right house, and, you know, all blah, 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 and then I'll be happy. And when we take up spiritual life, we just move that to spiritual life. You know, if I get to have the right service and I have the right this and the right that, then I'll be Krishna conscious. You know, it's the same thing. If I'm going to adjust, we're just putting a patina of spiritual talk on it. You know, that if I could just adjust the world, my if I just adjusted my body and mind, if I just adjusted all the other living entities, and if I just adjusted nature, then I would be happy. That's not the way to be happy in the material world. The way to be happy in the material world is to have to be a walking yajna, to be a walking sacrificial fire, to bring it within ourselves. That is the way. That is the instruction, ultimately, that Rishabhdev is giving, both verbally and by his own example, that one should epitomize a connection with the Lord at every moment. All right, so that's why. Why? Now we're going to look at the how. How are we going to do this? And for this, I turn to one of my favorite quotes, the letter that Prabhupada wrote to Jayapataka Swami in 1972, and those of you who've heard my classes, you have probably heard me talk about this before. Prabhupada writes, They do not know the secret of surrendering to Krishna. Such surrendered devotees sees. Now what is Prabhupada saying? That everything is part of Krishna's plan, that whatever is meant to be, I am doing that. That's the first point. Second point. So let me do it with my full attention to every detail. That's the second point. Third point. Let me become absorbed in such service, never mind what it is. That's the third point. Fourth point. Let all other considerations be forgotten. And the fifth point. And only my desire to do the best thing for Krishna's alone pleasure be my motive. All right, let's look at these points again. There's 5 points. First point. Everything is part of Krishna's plan. Whatever is meant to be, I am doing that. Second point. Let me do it with my full attention to every detail. Third point, let me become absorbed in such service, never mind what it is. Fourth point, let all other considerations be forgotten. Fifth point, only my desire to do the best for Krishna's alone pleasure be my motive. So I will put this into the chat so you can all see it. All right. So let's look at these one at a time, briefly. Everything is part of Krishna's plan. Whatever is meant to be, I am doing that. So this is true for everybody. This is true for materialists, demons, rascals. But it is super true for somebody who said to the Lord, my dear Lord, for this day on, I am yours. Then Krishna always has us in the right place. Now sometimes people may say, does that mean I can never change where I am? Well, that's ridiculous. Like right now, I'm sitting in my chair at my desk, but I'm not going to sit at my chair or my desk until I die. In fact, if I just kept sitting here, I would die rather quickly because I wouldn't be able to get anything to eat or drink. So it's not that we can never change our position, but it means that we are always exactly situated properly at any given moment. Now, sometimes the service we're supposed to do in a given moment is to plan how to be someplace else. Just like I'm going to be traveling in November for about 5 days, then one of the things I need to do is buy an airplane ticket. So I may have to do something today in this moment to prepare for something in the future. But what I am doing in this moment is perfect. So this is the first thing. Everything is part of Krishna's plan. Whatever is meant to be, I am doing that. We tend as materialistic creatures to have a restlessness. We tend to want to be finished with what we're doing so that we can do something else. And that kind of restlessness means we're never happy with what we're doing. We're constantly in a state of thinking about past or future. But rather that what I'm doing right now, where I am right now, who I'm with, who I'm interacting with, everything, this is all Krishna's plan. Krishna has some service for me here. I am a servant and I have some service here. So let me, next point, let me do it with full attention to every detail. So whatever we're doing, to really pay attention to the details. Just like I was talking about, you know, if I'm calling my son Keshava, I have to pay attention to the details. Is my phone charged? Do I have enough battery life for the duration of the call? You know, if I've only got 3% battery, then maybe I can't have an hour call with him. Or am I near a charger? Do I have a good connection? It's very frustrating to call somebody when you have a bad connection. Someone just left me a voice message with a terrible connection, and all it was frustrating. Do I have the right number? Am I calling at a time when it's going to be convenient for him to talk to me? I pay attention to the details. And that, if every act is a ceremony, if every act is a yajna, if I'm carrying the yajnic fire with me, then I need to be paying attention to the details. Even if you're going to say chanting the holy name where there's no hard and fast rules, I still want to be paying attention. I want to be attentive to the sound of the name. I want to be attentive to my mood. I want to be attentive to what I'm trying to achieve. All right, next thing. Let me be absorbed in such service, never mind what it is. So this is also, you know, the Buddhists call this mindfulness, present moment awareness. So I'm accepting that what I'm doing right now is perfect. It's part of Krishna's plan. It's perfect. I'm paying attention to the details. And I'm really absorbed in what I'm doing. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's taking a bug outside. It doesn't matter if it's folding laundry. And it doesn't matter if it's giving a Bhagavatam class or dressing the deities. Or talking about Krishna to 10,000 people at the United Nations. Whatever it is, I become fully absorbed in that. I fully absorb my consciousness in that. Again, this is a ceremony of connection. If I'm talking to somebody on the phone, you ever talk to somebody who's doing 1,000 other things? It's not palatable. So whatever I'm doing now for Krishna, I give it my full attention. Next point. Let all other considerations be forgotten. So this is the flip side of absorption in what I'm doing, is that if my mind wanders to other things, I pull it back. That whatever I'm doing at the moment, I give it my full attention and I let everything else go. Now, one way to do that is to make sure that I have time and energy to do all the things that I need to do. If I structure my life so that I'm giving all my time and energy to only one or two things and I don't have any energy left for anything else, then I'm going to feel anxiety about those other things. How am I going to get that done? How am I going to get that done? How am I going to get that done? And I always give the example of money. So let's say that you got paid in cash every month and that you allocated, you budgeted, okay, I have a certain amount of cash to spend on food, and you had a little envelope and it was marked food and you put the money in there you could spend on food, and I have a certain amount to spend on rent, and you put that money in an envelope, and I have a certain amount to spend on clothes, and you put that money in an envelope. And so then when you budget all your money and you know that you have enough for all these things. And so when you want to get food, you open up your envelope and you know that during that month you can spend all the money in that food envelope without worrying about how much money is left for other things, because you've already allocated money for those things. So we want to make sure that every day, every week, whatever, that we allocate the energy, particularly energy more than time, that we allocate the energy to do various things, so that when I'm doing one thing, like now I'm giving this class, if I take all my energy for the day and I spend it all on just this 1 hour class, then I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to be a student in a class in about an hour and 15 minutes. I've got to have energy for that. You know, I have to have energy for my japa, my Gayatri. I have to have energy to cook or to clean, right? And I have to have energy left for that. So what I'm allocating a certain amount of energy for giving this class, and then I can give it fully knowing that I have energy allocated for other things, and I don't have to think about them. While I'm giving the class, I don't have to think, oh, what about the prep I'm doing for the next class, and what about this, and what about that? I can let all those things by the wayside, because I know that when it's time to do those things, I can be fully absorbed in those things. And Prabhupada's last point, only my desire to do the best thing for Krishna's alone pleasure is my motive. So I want to do whatever I'm doing, I want to do the best that I can, which is different from the best that absolutely could be done by anybody at any time. Those two things are not the same. The best that I can is the best that I can right now with the time and energy that I'm able to allocate for it and the resources that I have on hand. That is vastly, vastly different from the best possible thing that could be done by anybody ever. Just like my daughter recently had a birthday, I asked her what she wanted, and she said, I'd like you to hire somebody to do a deep cleaning of my house. Now, she's an extremely clean person. And I said, this is very funny. The cleaners are going to come and have nothing to do. And she said, well, you know, there's things like the windows and behind the stove and this kind of thing. So, you know, the deep cleaning, I think three people came and they spent like 3 hours. So that's not the kind of cleaning she's going to do every week or every day. You know, then that would be all she would do.
So, you know, again, what is the absolute best that could be done by anybody is not necessarily the best that I can do right now with the time and energy and resources and so forth that I have. So I do the best for my service with the time, energy, resources that I have in the moment, and I do it for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna's alone pleasure is my motive. And this perhaps is one of the hardest things, to work without being attached to the result, without being attached to subtle results of getting praise and appreciation and allocates, or more gross results of getting facility or resources, or being able to look at something and say, I did that, I made that, I, you know. The only result is that Krishna is pleased. Krishna is pleased. And Krishna is pleased. Thankfully, pleasing Krishna is not difficult. Krishna is pleased by a little bit of water. Krishna was pleased by Vidura accidentally offering him banana peels. I mean, Krishna was pleased by Putana looking like a mother and trying to kill him. I mean, it really doesn't take much to please Krishna. He's extremely easily pleased. So Krishna is pleased primarily by our intent. Right? That's our intention to please him. And of course, if we have an intention to please him, then we're going to try to please him according to the words of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. We're not just going to make something up. We're not just going to say, you know, okay, I'm going to drink alcohol to please Krishna. I mean, one has to know what pleases Krishna. But Prabhupada says that Krishna consciousness is not narrow or stereotyped. There's an infinite number of things that please Krishna, and actually there's a very, very small number of things that are prohibited. And then that's my intention. And if Krishna's pleased, then even if the whole world is displeased, and even if the result is just awful, it doesn't matter. That's my happiness, that Krishna's pleased. So if we do these things, to see that everything is part of Krishna's plan, whatever is meant to be, I'm doing that. Let me do it with my full attention, every detail. Let me become absorbed in such service, never mind what it is, but let all other considerations be forgotten, and only my desire to do the best thing for Krishna's alone pleasure be my motive. If we do that, then we will be like Rishabhdev, someone who has taken the sacrificial fire into ourselves. And that will be the case even if we're ruling the world. You know, even if we're like Bharat, who's ruling the world and appearing to be a big materialistic person. And it will be the case if we're a sannyasi. Those things will be irrelevant. I mean, we will have to do different things at different times of life, but those things in and of themselves is not the point. We want to be like this. Atman yavaro pitahavan. That's what we want to be. We want to be taking the sacrificial fire within ourselves. Atmani yavaro pitahavan iyaha. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions?
Oops, I need a moment. I mean, just one second. Better ask your question fast, because Motsuji only has about 10 minutes, usually.
Yep.
Well, if nobody else is going to ask a question, I'll ask a question. You know, whenever I come across the activities of Rishabhadev, I always, many times I think of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, how he had the character that he would, like, do the opposite of how you would think a saintly person would act. Mm. He would sometimes dress in, at least one instance, he really dressed in an expensive dhoti and bordered nice like that, and then Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, "Why?" He just laughs, that, "Why are you dressed like this?" So he would do that to the bewildered materialistic people, you know, and stay in an outhouse and like that. So with Lord Rishabhadev, with other personalities like Gaurakishore Das Babaji, isn't that difficult to follow them?
We're not supposed to follow anybody in terms of a copy paste. Anybody. We're all individuals. You know, that's when we say follow, we're not supposed to just copy paste. and just say, well, I'm just going to do exactly what someone else is doing. I mean, that might be relevant if you're walking in the dark on a path and you don't know where you're going and you're just following someone who knows where they're going and you're stepping where they're stepping. But if we're going to talk about life in general, what we want to pick up is the principle of the thing. What is the principle of the thing? And follow that. And we want to follow their instructions. We want to follow the instructions of Guru, particularly, that are perfect for us as a person. And that may be different at different times. It will be different at different times of our life as well. That's what we want to follow. I mean, the idea of having a guru and the idea of having guides is that somebody can say, okay, you know, this is what's best for you. And this is what's best for you now. But the principle, that we want to take up.
So is that what happened to, what was it, Maharaj Arhat, you know, the Jains? Is
yes,
that they
yes,
were...
Yes.
So they saw his activities, they tried to imitate it, and therefore... teachings were lost.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
I found it interesting, shocking, that Rishabhdev remained home like a madman, naked, and with disheveled hair. I can't think of many other examples like that. I'm using someone with, you know, go off to the forest, like Jetta.
He does do that. You notice he did both. He stayed home for a while like that, and then he went traveling. I'm just thinking, I don't remember what part of the world I was in. I was in some part of the world, and we were doing a program at someone's home. So I don't remember if it was the mother of the husband or the mother of the wife. I cannot remember. I don't remember what part of the world it was in, and I don't remember which person's mother it was. But one of their mothers was living with them. And all she did was read scripture and chant. She didn't even have conversations with any of her family members. Now, she wore clothing, but she was basically living as an avaduta. She didn't interact with the family at all. She was not interacting with her child and her child-in-law, and she wasn't interacting with her grandchildren. She wasn't interacting with the guests that were coming for the program, and her mind was fine. She didn't have dementia or anything like that. She just simply didn't interact with anybody. She was living as an avaduta, although she was home. So, you know, that may be. But Rishabhdev, we see here in this one verse, it says that he was doing that at home, and then he went out. So how long he did it at home before he started traveling around is not given here.
Thank you.
Sure.
Could I ask you, because no one else is jumping in,
I could ask
you a question on one thing you said in passing. Anybody else want to ask you a question? Go ahead. You were mentioning about chanting at one point, and chanting non-offensively. It's, you know, you were talking very liberally how there's really hardly any rules and regulations for chanting. I mean, it's always going to act. It'll always be effective and, you know, efficacious. But then you mentioned that it wouldn't act if it was done offensively. Aren't there references in scriptures that even if someone offensively chants a holy name, there's still some benefit?
Those are usually for namabhas, which is a reflection or shadow of the name, but not offensive. And like if someone says, okay, let's go to the Cinerama, or, oh, look at those funny Hare Krishnas on the other side of the street, those sort of things And there are statements from our acharyas that one can be just simply saying the alphabet and not actually chanting at all if one is very offensive. It's possible to be chanting in such a way that really one doesn't get any effect. Like Lord Kapiladev says, if you're offering a sacrifice but you don't see the Lord in the heart of all living entities, you're making an offering into ashes. I don't think that's efficacious.
Like Kamsa was always meditating upon Krishna, but he hated him, and Shishupal as well. But Prabhupada points out that even though Kamsa was so absorbed in hate, he was becoming purified.
Well, Krishna is very, very kind, Narahari Prabhu. You know, I mean, I use the example all the time of Putana, because for most of us, we would rather a wolf than a wolf in sheep's clothing. I would much prefer an open enemy than an enemy who's pretending to be a friend. And I think that most people would feel exactly the same way. You know, an enemy who's pretending to be a friend, we're going to have a lot more hatred for than an open enemy. But Krishna took the fact that Putana was pretending to be a friend as a positive. That's amazing. He said, okay, I'll take your pretend friendship. I'll take your pretend motherliness and I'll count you as a mother. It's like, what? You know, who does this? Do you do this? I don't do this. You know, we human beings become most disturbed if somebody is an enemy in the guise of a friend. You know, that's the most disturbing thing. But Krishna was pleased by that. And that's why I say it's very easy to please Krishna. But not that we should take advantage of that. Because if we do, then we're sinning on the strength of chanting and it's offensive. So people like Kamsa and Shishupal and Pandraka, Putana, they weren't trying to sin on the strength of chanting. That wasn't their mentality at all. They were coming in touch with Krishna. And the other thing is that they were coming in touch with Krishna very emotionally. Yam Krodha Kama Sahaja Pranayati Bhiti Vatsalya Moha Guru Gaurava Savior Bhavai Sanchinchitasram Sabhitim Tanimaparete. They were coming to Krishna with some strong emotion. You know, they say even in our human relations, the opposite of love is not hate, the opposite of love is indifference. You know, we don't usually argue with people that we don't care about. If I don't care about what someone's opinion is, I'm not going to waste my time arguing with them. I mean, unless I'm an idiot. I mean, the only reason I can see to waste time arguing with someone I don't care about is if there's an audience that I care about. But if there's no audience that I care about and I don't care about the person's opinion, why would I waste time arguing with them? You know, they say that marriage is dead when the couple stops touching each other or talking to each other, when they basically ignore each other. It's not dead when they're fighting. So, you know, people having strong negative emotions toward Krishna, they are emotions. And those strong emotions will act as a shadow or a reflection of rasa. They're a rasa basa or a nama basa, which is a shadow or a reflection. And if you've got a shadow or a reflection, you're close to the real thing. You can't get a shadow or a reflection unless you have, and a shadow, of course, even closer. So it can go from the shadow to the reality. You're in a position where you can segue from a shadow to the reality. But that's quite different from intentionally taking up a path of bhakti but doing it offensively. It's a different creature.
That's helpful. Let me just ask you one last example.
Then I have to go.
Okay, what about we're out on Harinam chanting on the streets and somebody foolish person comes by and says, oh, you effing Hare Krishnas. I would think there's some benefit there.
Yeah, well, probably. Thoughts? People like that are generally more or less innocent.
Correct.
So, like, Prabhupada talked about how his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, would judge the value of an article by how many times it had Krishna's name, even if it said, you terrible Hare Krishnas. Again, you have a strong emotion there. But a lot of it has to do with innocence. I mean, the other day we took the children from our local school to the state fair, and in the state fair in North Carolina, there's a huge exhibit of traditional crafts. You know, there are people who are making their own pottery, their own baskets, their own all kinds of things. You know, and so the children are seeing all these different craftspeople. And in one of them, this lady was making baskets out of something called sweetgrass. And she was sitting behind the counter. They're also selling their stuff. So she was sitting behind the counter where her stuff was displayed. And these little children, we're talking 2 and 3 year old children, they just walk behind the counter and they're standing right next to this lady watching her. And I was thinking about how Prabhupada says this with the four Kumaras, that, you know, when they just go through the gates of Vaikuntha, you know, and Prabhupada says that the children are, they're allowed anywhere. They're not usually restricted. Yeah, but if I walked behind the counter, it would be an invasion of a boundary. It would have been threatening. It would have, you know, why would I be walking behind the counter? She would be worried that I would steal something. There would have been some negative reaction with these little three-year-olds walking there. It wasn't like that. I have to get this phone call. I'll